Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Andrew Mayer is an American movie producer and executive. He has served as the president of Herb Albert and Jerry Marcus's A&M Films, Robert Redford's Wildwood production, and Norman Lear's Act 3 productions. Notable among the films he has produced is Fried Green Tomatoes, which was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, a BAFTA Award, and several Golden Globe nominations. He developed and produced The Breakfast Club, which Entertainment Weekly named the best high school movie of all time. Andrew's company produced Birdie, starring Nicolas Cage, which won the Grand Jury Prize at the Cannes Film Festival. He is executive producer of Bring on the Night, which stars Sting and won a Grammy. Andrew's newest book, Walking in the Fast Lane, Stories of a Lifetime, is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and bookstores everywhere. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Andrew Mayer. Where in the world are you, and how are you doing?
I'm in Palm Springs, California, and I'm doing well. I am touring the country, talking about a new topic, which is of interest to me and a lot of other people, called reinvention, about how we all reinvent ourselves all day long, depending on who we're talking to and what we're doing, and how that can help you in your life and in the world, and how companies can reinvent. And my book, Walking in the Fast Lane, is really about how I kept reinventing myself from being a promoter to a record executive to a film executive to a producer of movies like The Breakfast Club and Fried Green Tomatoes and Better Off Dead and Birdie, and how I then ran companies for Norman Lear and Robert Redford. And so, you know, reinvention is what we're all doing. Only recently have I been able to sort of focus on that and turn it into a lecture and have it also be a reflection of my life, which is in the book that I wrote about.
So at what point in your career did you realize that reinvention was important and a key tool in your life and should be part of everyone's life? Or was it an understanding that you had from the beginning of your career?
It's really only something that recently I've been thinking about, because in writing the book, I realized that, you know, I wasn't qualified for any job I ever had. Started producing stadium concerts for the Sly and the Family Stone and the band and Miles Davis, and I'd never produced before. And then A&M Records hired me to promote records, and I'd never done that before. And so, you know, I discovered John Hughes in The Breakfast Club, and John and I had never done anything. He'd never directed, I'd never produced. So part of it is being open to being in the right place at the right time and making yourself available to be in the right place and the right time. And so really, reinvention is a retrospective kind of concept that has come to me recently looking back on my life and the book I wrote.
Okay, so now let's dive into that journey. I know it's multi-decades, multi-iterations. At what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you think, okay, I want to be in this creative world? And how did those journeys progress into the various iterations?
Well, that, you know, that's the interesting thing about it. It was, for me, I never woke up and said, I want to produce concerts. I was an English major in college, so I wasn't even involved in business. I reacted to events that were in front of me. I was just a regular high school kid. Nothing special, I promise you. And this is what annoyed me. The school asked me for $100 for the scholarship fund, and I didn't have $100, and I didn't have money for college. And it made me so mad that I said, we have to do something better. Why don't we produce a concert? And I convinced the school to let me produce a concert of a band called the Blues Project in a 5,000-seat stadium, and it raised a lot more than the stupid $100 scholarship. And I kind of react to things, you know, in college. And then I went to college. I didn't think I was a producer. But then I saw that the college had all these terrible musician, violin players and opera singers that, you know, it was the 60s and everybody was into Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead. And we were forced to pay for those bands out of our activity fee. And so I told them, let me take over producing the concerts. And I took them over because they were doing such a bad job. It's not because I said I'm a big-time producer. And I brought in the Grateful Dead and the band and Judy Collins. And then I went to work for A&M Records. It's always when I kind of see something that isn't right, more than I'm sitting there thinking, what do I want to be? I don't know if that's a clear explanation, but I reacted to events. And as an English major, I wasn't walking around saying I'm a big businessman. I was just saying there are lots of things wrong and I want to fix them.
So when you noticed these gaps and you took space in them, the producing of the concerts, being at AMM, the movie production, et cetera, et cetera. When you first started, was it a bit of hesitancy in the sense of, oh, I'm not quite sure? Or did you just say, I see how it's going to go? And you just went 1, 2, 3.
There's an expression, and I use it with my students. I'm a professor emeritus at the Savannah College of Art and Design in Georgia. I didn't know what I didn't know. So I was doing all these bold things. I didn't know that they were so difficult or that you had to have all this experience or you should have done more research. I just didn't know. And, you know, when I got to A&M Records, A&M Records was a standalone company. It didn't have a film company. And all the soundtracks were going to Warner Brothers because they had a film company, a record company in Columbia. And in those days, Saturday Night Fever and Grease were the biggest hits. And A&M Records, they weren't getting any soundtracks because they didn't have a film company. So I walked up to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. Again, I saw something wrong. And I just said to them, you know, we should be in the film business or we're not going to get any soundtracks. And they looked at me and they said, you're right. They were record guys. They had never thought of actually starting a film company. That's how I ended up running A&M Films and meeting John Hughes and making all the movies I made just because I asked one question, you know, and I do a whole lecture about how good ideas can come from anywhere, not from, you know, a vice president or, you know, I was just a promo guy. I said, how come we're not in the film business? And that really, The Breakfast Club never would have been what it was. Better Off Dead, you know, if I hadn't asked that question, I never would have done those movies probably. So, you know, it's kind of a wrinkle in time, I would say.
Okay, a couple of steps back. Maybe it's changed since you've done it, because it's been a few years. What does it mean to produce a concert?
Well, it has changed tremendously. But when I did it, it was real old school, hands-on, putting up posters. It was sort of a nostalgic thing to do because nobody does any of that anymore. It's all digital. But, you know, it's managing talent. It's selling. You know, I learned how to promote and convince people to go. I mean, I had the Grateful Dead. It wasn't too hard to convince people to go. But I had to find the right facility, and I had to get people to work with me. You know, most of life is about teamwork, and producing is about teamwork, convincing people to go with you to do whatever task you want to do. And that hasn't changed, but it's become so digital now, and there are so many monopolies with concerts. It's not as creative as it used to be, but it's probably more efficient.
What does it mean to be a producer on a film?
What I was on all my films was an executive producer. So I was the only one who was there from the beginning of the idea to the development of the script, to the physical production of the movie, to the marketing of the movie and the distribution of the movie. And now, you know, 40 years later, I'm still doing interviews about The Breakfast Club and Fried Green Tomatoes. Breakfast Club had its 40th anniversary last year. Fried Green Tomatoes has its 35th anniversary this year. And so in a way, I'm still producing those movies 4 years later. So my job never stops. Now, a line producer, so when you see produced by, that's somebody, and this is very general because it's all different with different people, but who, you know, goes and physically makes the movie. An executive producer is more involved in financing and distribution and overseeing the kind of big picture. And that's what I was.
How much say does a producer have in what's happening on day to day?
It's not your money. Whosever money it is decides the big thing. So I never personally financed films. So if I had day to day, say, as long as the money, which is the studio or the financier, approved. It's risk reward. You know, if you want to put the money up, you can control everything. If you don't want to put the money up, then somebody else ultimately controls everything because it's their money. You're more of a consultant than a final decision maker on major things, but on, you know, day-to-day things, I would decide a lot every day, as long as it was within the budget and the studio understood what I was doing.
Did you realize at the time of creating these movies, The Breakfast Club, Fried Green Tomatoes, that these were something special and the legacy that they would create, or are you still surprised by the impact?
When we made The Breakfast Club, we were just hoping it would get in theaters. It was a little movie. When I met John Hughes, I walked into his living room and he had posters all the way around his living room of Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Home Alone. And I walked in and he was going to sell me something. He had planned 5 years of his life. He knew the five movies he was going to make. And so I said, which movie, what script should I read? He said, well, you have to read The Breakfast Club because I have to direct my first movie. So I wrote The Breakfast Club in one room thinking you might let me direct. That's why The Breakfast Club was in one room, so that he could direct. And I had just started and I didn't know anything about producing and he didn't know anything about directing, but we got $1 million to make a little independent movie. But Universal then came in when we started sort of shooting and said they took it over. But we really didn't know until we screened the movie in front of an audience what we had. And generally, you don't know until you screen the movie in front of an audience. You know, you can sit with the crew and they're all happy. Nobody was saying, you know, who's going to be catering the 40th anniversary? There was none of that. It was, can we get in a theater? Because, you know, in those days, there were big studio movies. It was Universal Pictures. There were, you know, there was Jaws. There's all these huge movies. And The Breakfast Club was like a little kid sitting around talking. And there were no expectations. It was a tremendous surprise to everybody. And you know, now it's become sort of a legendary. There are thesis papers written about it. There are classes being taught around it, about it. And Better Off Dead was a little $3 million movie that it took me 2 years to get the money because the director, whose name was Savage Steve Holland, that's really his name, it's his name now, had never directed a film before. He was an animation major, and I had to convince people to let an animation major direct a feature film, and that took several years. And that was just a little movie on TV budget, and that's become a cult classic. So you just can't, you can't predict, really. I've been on movies where everybody loves each other and we're having a great time and the movie's terrible. And I've been on movies where everybody was miserable and we just wanted to go home and the movie was great. So, you know, it's hard to tell.
Now, obviously, as you're in the process of being on a set for movie, there's a lot of risk, as you mentioned, risk versus reward. Have there in the past any times for you specifically where you weren't sure about various things? And you know, you get that voice in your head, that doubting voice in your head where it starts like, oh, I don't know if we should do this, should do that. Or were you always steadfast, you know, okay, this is a path and we need to stick to that?
Well, once you decide to make a movie, you don't have those kind of choices. I mean, once you get the money and you start shooting the movie, it's not a matter of, you know, maybe this was a mistake. You have to really commit to several years of your life to make a movie and bring everybody along. You know, you're sort of the Pied Piper of the movie business in that you're the producer and you get a script and you get a director, and then you have to convince people to work on it. The decision comes early and there's no turning back. You know, when you're developing things, that's a different conversation. Then you have a script and you can say, let's not do it, or you have an idea and you can say, well, let's not develop it. But once you start physically making a movie, it's all hands on deck.
I'm not sure if you're aware. Do you know what percentage of scripts actually land up being movies?
Yes, I do. The studios are terrible at developing. They don't really want to be in the development business. Their ratio of development to production is probably three scripts for the 25. So even if a studio options your script and wants to develop it, that doesn't mean it's going to get made. Many times I've had scripts developed by Universal, and I told my friends I was making a movie, and then they said, oh, no, you're just developing a movie. It never gets made. It's not the business they want to be in. Studios are content distributors, and even now, with what's going on with the merger with Warner Brothers and Netflix and Paramount, you know, they're more and more in the distribution streaming business than they are in the creative development business. All the studios would be much happier if somebody just brought them a finished film and they could just distribute it. The rest of it is just annoying for them.
You referenced that you worked as executive president of Robert Redford's. Tell us about that part of your journey.
Norman Lear and Robert Redford are two of the most iconic figures in American history, and I was fortunate to run their companies. And with Norman Lear, he also had his television business, and he and I made Fried Green Tomatoes together, and you know, it was a difficult movie to make. It took 5 years because the script was so hard to adapt. And Norman was great. You know, he was one of my mentors. And Robert Redford was sort of the epitome of, you know, when he came to me and talked to me about a job, I looked at what he did. And everything he'd done, I admired. The Sundance Institute, his directing, his starring in movies, his leading, you know, having Sundance have all these programs for young people. I'm a big fan of mentoring. I spent my life mentoring young people. And I just so admired the way he also, you know, put his money where his mouth is. He wanted to make independent films, have a place to show away from the big studios, and Sundance was that. And I was honored just to be able to work with both of them. It's very hard to find more iconic figures to work for than Robert Redford and Norman Lear. So I was really lucky and grateful.
Is the Sundance Festival still going?
It is still going. It's in its last year in Sundance, but it's moving to Colorado.
Okay.
So there will always be a Sundance, but Robert Redford passed away this year. It's,
yes.
All we know.
Same.
And Sundance, which just finished, had its last sort of hurrah in Park City and will be in another city in another state next year. But it's still going.
I've heard a lot of reports coming through, especially from Hollywood, that I'm not sure if it's studios or producers, they're requesting simplified scripts. But so many people on their cell phones now while watching movies or televisions, so they now it's the second screen. What are your thoughts on this whole debate of the second screen, simplified scripts, and that topic?
It started before the simplified script context you're talking about. The business has changed because it used to be 70% of the money came from the United States and the rest came from around the world. And now it's reversed. Most of the money comes from around the world and not as much from the United States because they're, you know, the theater business is dying and it's booming around the world. So because of that and the language difficulties, you know, for big studio films, you were urged to, you know, not write really complicated dialogue scenes because they'd all have to be dubbed and translated. Uh-huh. So it was more about the international market than cell phones.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't realize that. Thank you. That's interesting. You've been in the industry a number of decades. For you, as we mentioned earlier, that there's a lot of digital that's come through. What are the main observations or changes that you've noticed across the industry, movies, music, for better or worse, that has changed over the past time that you've been in the industry?
Well, it's consolidation, you know, and it's in other businesses too. But right now, you know, the number of studios is going to be really small because they're all consolidating it into one huge bureaucracy. I mean, it's still being contested by Paramount, but it'll be Netflix and Warner Brothers merging, and Netflix isn't interested in the physical theater business. So, you know, if they show a movie in a theater, they're talking about showing it for 10 days. It used to be 6 months, though.
Yeah.
They'll show, or 6 weeks, they'll show a movie. And so the change will be that you're going to get more and more streaming content and less original content in theaters. And it's going to, I think, hurt the creative artists who really want to do original work. You know, the most interesting work is being done outside the United States. And all of the great filmmakers are coming from outside the United States. You know, in America, it's such a difficult time with it being so expensive to make movies in America that really in Europe, there are some great directors and around the world. And so the creativity will live on, and I think, but it'll be outside of the U.S., which is okay with me.
You decided to write your book. What was the inspiration? You decided, okay, I want to put down pen to paper my life story. Is that correct?
Well, it started 50 years ago. I was thinking of that this week. 50 years ago, I was 26 years old, and I made the decision, I was working at A&M Records, that I was going to take a year off and travel around the world by myself. That was sort of a gift I gave myself. And so then I told A&M I needed a year off. So in order to not totally look like a loser, I said, I'm going to write a book. So 50 years ago, I took a typewriter and a backpack and carbon paper. Your audience will have to Google to find out what that is. And traveled the world for a year by myself, typing letters and sending them back to people, but keeping the carbon copies of stories of what I saw as I traveled. And I did that for about 6 months and mailed the letters. And some of those letters are in the book that, you know, Walking in the Fast Lane. But then I realized, about halfway into the trip, I really didn't know anything. I was 26 years old, and I wasn't ready to write a book. And then last year, I decided that 50 years later, I have some stories to tell. And quite honestly, I was in places and saw things that if I didn't write about them, nobody would know because people aren't around anymore. And, you know, I was there for the We Are the World concert. It was the most famous recording ever, still the largest selling single in the world. So I'm sort of like Zelig in a way. I'm in a lot of places in the book writing about things that the people aren't here anymore. And they're, you know, famous and not famous. They're just really interesting stories. I was never qualified for any job I ever had. So as I kept moving around, I sort of explained the process where how I learned on the job and how you can do that as well. You know, when you're in a job interview and they ask you if you can do something, just say yes. Don't even think no. Say yes and, you know, figure it out later. I sat down and wrote all the stories I'd been collecting, and that's why the book is called, you know, the subtitle is Stories of a Lifetime. Stories of my years in the record business and the film business, my years teaching, my years traveling the world, and, you know, hopefully they'll be interesting to other people. That's the idea.
So were you actually in the studio when they recorded We Are the World?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Because it was at the A&M studios, and my office was literally 50 feet away. And I just walked over, and above me was George Harrison, and the A&M recording studio was 50 feet away from me. So, you know, Peter Frampton and Supertramp, everybody would come and record there. So, and I was 23 years old at the time. And so, you know, I sort of saw a lot. And I write about that in my book. You know, I spent a couple of days with George Harrison writing his biography and watching him, and I came away with some observations. I actually found George Harrison's wife, Olivia, because she was working at A&M as a part-time temp, and George said to me he needed a temp to help him in the office, and I sent Olivia up, and she was his partner for all his life, really. You know, there are meaningful things that happen that I talk about in the book.
So you mentioned earlier about reinvention and pitching up in different situations when you're with different people. For me, this is an interesting topic because there are societal labels of the MD, the CEO of artists, of famous person, inverted commas, and often people put on masks. They put on a different mask of who they really are when they meet famous person, CEO, because they think they need to put that mask on in order to interact with that person in that way, because that person's got that label. For me, I say that everyone uses two-ply toilet paper. There's no gold-plated toilet paper. The way, same way I speak to you, the same way I speak to my colleagues in office, the same way I speak to the lady at the checkout counter, there's not this elevation of a mask. So for anyone who's struggling between reinvention compared to wearing masks, what would you say to them?
I know where you're heading. And the thing that I found being with very famous people, and because I was so young, and again, I didn't know what I didn't know, I just treated them like everybody else. And they wanted to be treated like everybody else. And, you know, I found that many of them were lonely and happy to have my company because they're, you know, Robert Redford had the most famous face in the world. We couldn't go anywhere without people following him. So he was happy to just sit in the room and chat with me or anybody that he liked in a private place, because otherwise people were just after him all the time. And, you know, I mean, he could never even go to a museum. We had to open the museum early and go before it was open. So when you have that kind of life, you know, you do cherish people around you who you trust. And I think your observation is astute, is that they want to be as regular as you are. They want to be able to go to the store and hang out with their friend. But, you know, they envy you because they can't do that. They're sitting in their 8-bedroom suite at the Hotel Astoria, and they can't get out because the crowds are waiting for them to come out. So in a way, they're as envious of you as you are of them with their fabulous life. And if you think of it that way, then, you know, they're just regular people too. Everybody has a need, and theirs is what your life is. Many times, you know, I'd be with George Harrison, or who has spent a lot of time with her, Robert Redford, and, you know, they would just say, can I go to this place? And we go, no, you can't go to that place. Are you kidding me? There'll be a mob immediately. And he'd be disappointed because, you know, especially, you know, with the Beatles, you know, they were rowdy teenagers playing, you know, in strip clubs in Germany. When they started, they had a regular teenage rock and roll life. And many of them missed that, you know, that they missed the challenge and dangers of their youth. They're so protected and guarded. So it's a two-way street.
The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the audience, what would you like to say?
I would like to say that, you know, I've decided to spend the year talking to people about the opportunities of reinventing your life and looking for ways, because the only constant in the world is change. And if you accept that principle, then reinvention is an excellent way for you to move forward. You're working in a company by coming up with a different idea, like I did with A&M Records, why don't you be in the film business, or coming up with what I call the third thing. The third thing is a concept I've been working on in my lectures. It's very important. And that is, you have your friends and family. That's one thing. You have your job. That's the second thing. The third thing is what is only yours, that is separate from everyone else. And it can be karaoke singing or skydiving or playing the violin. Something that my son throws discus, and he's a big social media guy. That third thing gives you an opportunity, perhaps, to start a whole new career. I mean, I do a whole lecture about people who, as a third thing, working on something that ended up being a huge business opportunity. So be open to understanding the only constant is change. Be open to reinventing yourself, and also try and get that third thing. And that's what I'm really talking about. It's a topic I'm really interested in, and I'm going to speak to people all over the world about it.
Amazing.
And thank you for inviting me on the show, and I really enjoyed talking to you. It's a great show.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.